noticing, those of you in your winter coats, Tim and Jason are trying to work it out so that the sound of the heating system doesn't drown out my voice. Yeah, so lunchtime we'll crank it up, right? Yeah, okay. We'll try to let the residue from lunch move into the afternoon too. All right, so I wanted to check in with you and see how things are going and what's on your mind. Anything that's on your mind, for those of you who were here yesterday, maybe the five recollections somehow, I don't know, affected your evening or affected your sleep or affected your morning, because sometimes that's how these things work. I'm also interested in the evening out of the postures practice that we did this morning, the sitting, walking, standing, and lying down. What happened? How did that go? So we'll just open it up. Anything that you want to look at together, or ask about, or investigate, please feel free to do so. Yeah. Defensive metta, yeah. Say again?
That's the first time I've heard that expression.
That's because I made it up. I really did because I haven't heard that from anyone, but I see it and I know it, so offering it from experiential reasons. Well, what connected with you around it? What, you know, why did it interest you? So when you remember metta and something is happening that's a little bit off or uncomfortable or something like that, and then there's some degree of the capacity to extend friendship? Is that along the lines of where you're going? Or where we're going together? No. Okay. Can you say it again, and can you say it louder? Because I'm not really getting it all.
So what I said here, when either me or somebody else is being very friendly in a kind of maybe lonely kind of way, it feels actually like they're
inaccessible. Like a bit intrusive way?
That they're inaccessible, like it's somehow a friendly, a barrier, like you can't actually get through.
Oh. Oh, I see. Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah, okay. Because what you're describing is definitely defensiveness, but I wouldn't call it metta. I would call it persona or... maybe perhaps in that moment the incapacity to open to the totality of what's going on. So kind of using the personality, maybe defensive personality, you know, using the personality to push discomfort away or push anything that might not be able to stay on a certain level away because of fear and because of not wanting to swim in those waters. And I think we have to respect that. You know, when we're with someone, I'm not saying when we're doing it, we might want to look at it, but when we're interacting with someone who's doing that, I I feel that it's important to let people be as they are and to recognize that that it has to be respected. Yeah, and that something will maybe shift or open or change according to their own experiences and also their own interests and their own inclinations. Because we cannot make anyone be the way we want them to be. And did I hear something? Just a cough? Maybe a cough? Oh, a laugh from the... Right, right. Yeah. Yeah. And so honoring what is in that moment, the connectedness that can be there in that moment. It's like you don't have to cooperate with what feels like a lack of connectedness. We can bow to it and respect it and let that person be the way that they are. But inwardly, we don't have to cooperate it. We can still continue to be ourselves and to offer ourselves, you know, in appropriate ways, of course. Yeah. But that wasn't really what you were asking. Good. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I am having such a hard time hearing. What should we do? Should we freeze for the next 20 minutes and then why don't we just
stand up? That usually projects your voice better.
Okay, we could try that. We could try that. Yeah. Okay, good, yeah. The formal way of working with them might be to introduce them into your sitting practice. And I know practitioners who do that. Some practitioners take them on every day and in the sitting practice move through them, sometimes fairly quickly, sometimes more slowly, but basically the practice, thank you so much. I'm so sorry. I think it's my voice just being the way that the voice is, a little on the soft side. Do you have other people who you don't have to do this with? They have louder voices? No? Yeah? Yes? Okay. It's a challenge of the building. Okay. All right. Yeah, I mean, there's nothing I can do about it anyway, but it's nice to know. So I always feel like the Dharma, it's good if it rolls over you and you can relax back and receive it rather than having to strain to hear. Yeah. So this is great. Thank you. I appreciate it. So the basic practice that we undertook yesterday in the guided meditation was to call forth the first of the recollections and then to listen. You can't like just try to convince yourself that you know them or anything like that. It's more a matter of listening, moving from the I to the we at some point, or from the we to the I. It doesn't matter. You can start with we and you can move to I. I feel that it's important to include both, because if you miss the I, this sense of universality can be a way of trying to transcend what you need to actually take as an I. You know, it feels that it impacts one personally. Okay. So two things with that. One is to definitely continue in your formal sitting practice with just being with the breathing or just being with sound, or, you know, not opening up to choiceless awareness, to whatever it is that's happening, but have an object of attentiveness that you you go to over and over and over again whenever you're disconnected or wandering around in thought. Because that's the training. That's kind of like the guts of the practice. It's like doing weight training. We're training our minds in the same way. And generally, we all start off with completely disconnected, fragmented minds. And so to put the time in to collect and to steady and to encourage what I've been talking about is an inner sense of harmony or focus is really essential. It's, you know, it's the samadhi, the shamatha samadhi part of the practice. Our practice is first training ourselves in shamatha, which means calm, and samadhi, which is sometimes translated as concentration, but I don't like that word. The hard edges of that word don't really work for me. So I use the word collectedness or steadiness. But being able to encourage a kind of sustained attentiveness. So it's not just one moment every so often, but there's a capacity to sustain our attentiveness. When we can sustain our attentiveness, we see all sorts of different things. We don't just see endings of things. We see beginnings of things. We see middles of things. We see into the true nature of phenomena because of being able to sustain our attentiveness long enough. Yeah. So this sustaining is really an important component of the practice. And then, of course, the other important component is vipassana, you know, inquiry, investigation, seeing into things as they are. But it's really hard to do that if we don't have a well-trained mind. And so choosing an object and sticking with that object can be where this kind of weight training comes in, or strength of heart training comes in. And what happens is that if we strengthen our hearts and train our minds, we're able to be with the difficult, be with the painful, without having to move into discursive thinking. Because you could say in those moments when you're with a recollection, but you move into discursive thinking, maybe that discursive thinking on some level is defensive, to use that word again. You know, perhaps it's defensive. It's moving you into the familiar, the easier, what you're used to, rather than the moment of, you know, of panic or of fear or of hopelessness or of despair or whatever is there because of conditioning that needs to be uncovered so that you can relax the squeeze. Yeah. To use that language of the constant squeeze, so that you can really begin to and continue to relax that squeeze. You know, and to call it a squeeze, you know, sometimes it's a vice, right? Yeah. And sometimes it doesn't feel like it's there at all. And that's where bringing up any of the recollections can remind you that it is there. Yeah, right. You know exactly what I'm talking about, right? Right. Yeah. Because to pretend that things are not the way they are, it's not a path. You know, it's just being mired in delusion and ignorance, and it's not a path of wisdom. It's not a path of awakening. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. So you're interested. I mean, you're asking this question because it's interesting to you, these recollections. So I would encourage you to practice formally, perhaps in your sitting. If you have two sits a day, it can be elegant to have one sit where you're just, you know, you're just with the breath, or you're just with metta, you're just the one object kind of thing, to encourage collectedness and steadiness. And then the second sitting, perhaps the recollections. Yeah. So that would be practicing with it formally. And I think the point here for you has to do with the discursive thinking. Yeah, right. So when you're practicing it formally, and you bring up a recollection and you're off and running, it's still worth it to practice with them. You know, regardless of how trained your mind is, it doesn't matter. It's still worth it to practice with them. But to see if you can come back to the moment of perhaps uneasiness or anxiety or funny feeling. You know, these things are sometimes not easy to put into words, but that feeling of something not being quite right. You know, perhaps you can physically feel a bit of a squeeze. Yeah, and that's what you want to turn towards. That's exactly what you want to turn towards, because that's where we get intimidated. You know, that's where we back away instead of gently and lovingly opening the door. You know? Yeah, and that opening the door, that offers relief from the squeeze in our willingness to kindly and compassionately face what is. You know, it's not ever what our minds make it up to be. It's just what is in the here and now. You know, when we think about it, it has to do with a dire future or with things looking a certain way, our imagination. But when we're able to just be with it as it is, we can tolerate it most of the time. You know? And when we can't, that's okay. That's where we back up into the one object, or we back up into the breath, or we back up into loving kindness practice, and that's great. You know, we rest, we refresh ourselves, we continue to strengthen our hearts and calm our minds, and then when we're ready, we jump back into the fray once again. Yeah, we're learning to swim, not interested in drowning. Good, thank you. And in terms of bringing it out into everyday life, I just really appreciated what Daniel said yesterday about taking this for a spin. I don't know if you, right, he was talking about taking it into situations where there are big groups of people and or the subway or public transportation or whatever. And it is a really wonderful way to take up this practice, is to be with a group of people. And, you know, our little aversions and our little judgments and our little pettiness and our little attractions and our little, you know, and I'm really using this word little because we're with people we don't even know. It's bigger when we're with people we know. But when we're with people we don't know, we can really just see all of the views and opinions and, you know, concepts and likes and dislikes and all of that with a bigger sense of perspective because it doesn't feel so personal to us, right? Yeah, and then we can practice with that. And then, you know, all beings are of the nature to age. Aging is unavoidable. And then we experiment, we play around with it. We look at a little baby and we already see them as an older person. Or we see an older person and we play around with it. We see their baby, that they were a baby. You know, we play around with things when we bring up these contemplations too. And that's not discursive thinking. That is actively engaging the contemplations. You know? It's not even something that we plan to do. It's more that if we're not lost in thought, then a kind of creativity becomes available to us, and the practice guides us. You know, our hearts guide us. We lead with our hearts. Yeah. Okay. Who else? Anybody? We only have a few minutes, but so you don't have to talk fast. But time later on. But is there anything right now that anyone wants to bring forth? Yeah.
People often say, are you like a glass half full or glass half empty person?
And yeah.
So I've always thought of myself as a person with a glass half full. And maybe I have that gene. but I was interested in this morning when you were talking about how important that is as kind of a ground.
Right. More about that. Yeah. I do feel sometimes it gets lost as that which is really important as a part of our practice because of the fear around attaching to it. Yeah. And we hear a lot about don't attach to meditative pleasure. And it's really good advice because, you know, you have to get yourself off of that one at a certain point. And hopefully you work with a teacher that's going to get you off. I mean, I remember very clearly working with someone, and it was like I was holding onto the windowsill for dear life. You know, meditative pleasure. It's the best there can be in life, you know. And feeling myself being yanked away. And I wanted it, obviously, because I wouldn't have chosen to be in that situation if I didn't want it. I knew something that I didn't know. Uh-huh. And the unfamiliarity of being yanked away from that meditative pleasure. So it's crucial to not be attached to meditative pleasure, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't have its place. Yeah, it's really important. Its place is really important. And we have to, I think when we hear the instructions don't attach to it, we have to consider for ourselves what is going on in a given moment. You know, I'm thinking of a student who had a very, very rough time of it, not just as a child, but also because of living in a particular country where it was extraordinarily difficult. And coming to the Dharma, coming to this practice, and hearing all of this about don't attach and don't cling, and of course that's the best that can be offered is don't attach, don't cling, because that is what can truly relax the squeeze, soften the squeeze, open us up to really what our hearts long for, which is not meditative pleasure, because that comes and goes. But for this particular practitioner, going for it, you know, because of not knowing that in his heart, not having any of that kind of experiences because the conditions were so difficult and he didn't have instructions. He didn't know a way to train himself in that direction. So I think whatever we value is going to come about. You know, whatever we think is important is going to come about. So if we have this sense of balance that no, we can't attach, we can't cling to that which is impermanent because it's not going to bring the deepest joy that is possible. That doesn't mean that the kind of meditative joy that we can experience in our practice is not deeply nourishing. It is deeply nourishing. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And as I was saying before, it offers this independence where we find ourselves less reliant on how other people are because they're never going to be the way we want them to be. You know? So it's kind of extraordinary to recognize we don't have to leave the world because people are, you know, other people are not us and so are always going to be wrong in some way, that we can engage and we can love and we can enjoy, but we don't have to be overly dependent because we know joy within our own hearts. Yeah. So I think it's important. Yeah. You know, different ways of nourishing joy. It's an interesting thing, but if you are really just with the breath for some amount of time, there's going to be a sense of well-being that comes out of that. Just enjoying your breath there's going to be a sense of well-being. And then you let that spread, you know, you let that expand. I'm sure you're familiar with gratitude practice, but that's a good way to nourish joy. You know, and that's such a reasonable way because it's always about good things that already are. You know, and you want to be really modest about it. Oh, the breeze against the cheek, not I have everything I want kind of thing. I think it's really important to be modest with our gratitude practice. Yeah. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh, the bliss of a tooth that is not aching is a good one. Yeah. We don't notice that until our tooth is aching. Oh, yeah. You know, I think you're right, because it's not as if we don't want to be able to, at a certain point, to sit on our own and enjoy our own company. And somebody said to me that not long ago that they were so afraid to sit because they felt they would be lonely. And she felt that she actually had herself with her in a way that she had never understood before. Yeah. So I thought that was wonderful that she didn't feel lonely at all. But sitting with others, there's something that is so helpful and so supportive, because I think we're offering ourselves to others. So, you know, whatever our self-doubt or unworthiness, just by being here with one another, we're offering ourselves as a refuge for others. And then we are experiencing the refuge of sitting with others as well. And there are particular times when you really need to sit with other people. You know, when you've had a recent loss in your life, loss of a person, it's not so easy all the time to sit alone. And to have other people around you to ground you, to join you, can be extraordinarily important, so that you don't lose your practice when you most need it, you know, which might happen because of how daunting it can feel to experience the emotions that are occurring with a loss. Yeah. Okay, so lest you not think I have forgotten food, it's time to eat. So 25 of, and Jim was going to talk for a few minutes, but let me do the time thing first. An hour.